Who the Wild Things Are with Ryan McGuire.
You gotta listen to your body.
Oh my God, maybe, you know, I could get out there. I could do this.
Let's take a ride. Find your wild side. Real stories. See with your own eyes.
It's so beautiful.
I'm gonna have the best time out here.
Yeah, I was in tears. I was just like, that's the best, man.
Welcome back to Who the Wild Things Are. My name is Ryan McGuire, and I'm here to bring you conversations with the most wild folks on the planet. If you're enjoying the podcast, please leave us a rating and review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you enjoyed the episode, share it with a friend. Appreciate you guys. Let's get it going. All right. Episode 2. My friend Austin Nicholas. How you doing, man?
Doing great.
Good.
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, glad to have you back in the room. If anyone hasn't checked out first episode of our last crazy adventure, definitely recommend checking that one out.
Yeah, that was a wild run.
Wild run, good conversation, and some practical guidance for anybody trying to get into doing hard shit, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, this one's been through it.
That's a go-to shirt.
Yeah, this was given to me by a buddy at the gym. He's got a company called A Different Breed. He's a veteran and absolutely shredded to the gills, and approached me one day and was like, hey, I want you to have something, and ended up giving me this shirt and a couple hats, and love supporting his stuff.
Sick. Yeah, they make I didn't know they make mediums. So that's
this is actually a double XL.
Okay.
If you can't tell, I've been hitting the gym quite frequently and have really been slacking on the running. But
What's the switch there? You feel like you want to get big and not focus as much on the ultra stuff?
It's not that I don't want to focus so much on the ultra stuff, because I do have Mesa's Hideout, which is a 100-mile race down in the Beulah National Forest coming up in June of next year. It's more that I just want to see what's possible with my body and sort of take a different avenue that I haven't pursued before.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you're getting bigger, I'm getting smaller.
Yeah.
Not a good time to pick a fight.
Yeah. You're looking pretty lanky and lean.
Yeah. I'm looking slender.
Yeah.
But that's all right.
Yeah. What races do you have coming up?
Just, got the 100-miler in 2 weeks. So that'll be interesting. I haven't really put in any long efforts since Colorado Trail, but I feel like a lot of my fitness has, you know, will carry over. And then after that, it's mainly high rocks and like hybrid racing.
Mm.
So lots of running and a little bit of strength here and there.
Yeah. But more endurance based strength, right?
Yeah. More strength, endurance kind of stuff. I don't know. I think I might've had my big phase, which wasn't very big. Right. I don't know if like my mind or my spirit is really interested in getting like super big now.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel super practical for the things I want to do.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily for me getting aesthetically like giant as much as it is just seeing how strong I can get, and then size naturally manifests along with, you know, eating and lifting really heavy stuff. So
yeah.
I'm that guy in the gym that's looking really pretty, grunting and straining and sweating all over the equipment. So
that's good.
I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying this phase.
Yeah. And you had a successful hunting season so far. So that's exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. One out of two so far. Missed out on the bear tag. Unfortunately, didn't see any bears. But yeah, I ended up going to meet up with a friend of mine who had been out there for 6 days and did not see anything worth shooting. And I ended up getting there around 6 p.m., about an hour before dark on Friday night. And he was hunted out. He told me he planned to leave the next morning. So I went out for a quick hike with my pack in case I did come across something that I liked and wanted to camp out there, and glassed this area, didn't see anything, so it was starting to get dark. Made my way back towards camp, and as I summited this ridge, I saw a nice 3x3 at about 135 yards, and he didn't see me, and I made a perfect shot, and it was a really successful hunt, probably my most successful hunt of all time. And my buddy was initially very pissed off and then very happy for me. But we were up well into the night processing it, and then ended up hiking it back to camp. I think it was like 20 degrees. It was pretty cold, but we were, when you find success on a hunt, it's almost like the elements don't really matter, just because you feel that adrenaline and the elation of success.
Yeah, it's a lot of pressure building up into that moment.
Yeah. I mean, lots of work, right? A lot of people that look at social media or see a hunting show on TV, they think that hunting is just going out into the woods with a gun, immediately shooting something that you see, and then going back home. But the reality of it is the countless hours spent glassing and sitting there and not seeing anything, mm-hmm. and the patience involved in continuing to come back out into harsh environments without success. And then finally, when the payoff does come, it's a glorious thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's just to get the animal on the ground. Then the other work starts to happen. You got to take the animal apart, you got to process it, pack it out. I guess in this case you had a buddy with you, so that's always a little added bonus to have a friend to help carry.
Yeah, it's always nice to have somebody that's there for that portion of the hunt. I will say I do enjoy hunting with other people, but my greatest success has come when I've hunted solo, primarily because there's one less set of footsteps to be heard by the animals. And I think there are a lot of variables where a lot can go wrong when multiple people are introduced. But yeah, it's the process of cutting up an animal and putting it into your pack and hiking it out. It's not a pretty process, but it's something that I think everybody should do at least once in their life to understand that meat consumption, there is a price to pay for that. And we've gotten so far away from that as a society, where we see this pretty little vacuum sealed package in the grocery store aisle, and we can look at the colors and things that we like and hand pick them. But the reality is that they're artificially colored with carbon monoxide. Those animals have been mistreated their entire lives in mainly factory farming operations. And even when it comes to a lot of organic food, who knows, unless they're, you know, specifically determined to be, you know, very ethical in their practices. I think a lot of companies, if they pay enough money, they can get that organic label slapped on there, and you know, people think that it's just ethical all of a sudden.
Right. And that was kind of, I think it started, there's this video of Fairlife. Have you ever heard about that company?
Yeah.
So like if you're in the gas station and you see some of those like protein milks and they say Fairlife on them. So that company had a huge lawsuit because some undercovers went in there with like chest cams, and it is a horrifying video. These dudes are just like beating the shit out of baby cows, like for no reason. They're just moving them and they'll just like flying knee this cow like into the gut, and it's just like a baby cow and it just like squeals and runs away. It is absolutely fucking terrifying. And I watched that and I was like, yeah, I don't know that I want to be part of that. Like, I want to try and get, like, I'm always going to be a meat eater, but I want to try and get meat from somewhere where like the animal's like loved and appreciated, not like a nuisance and like the enemy of the work. It's like the prize of the work. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. There's some nasty shit in that business, like the factory farming.
Yeah. That there's something to be said for having a connection to your food. Mm-hmm. Every time I pull a deer steak out of the freezer, I'm reminded of that experience that I shared with that animal in a beautiful setting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like when I give meat to others as gifts, you know, I'm giving the gift of that experience to them. And a lot of people don't understand that because they've never been in that situation, but you'd be hard pressed to find somebody that feels that same gratitude and that same connection to the meat that they buy from the store, right? Yeah. They take it for granted.
Yeah.
And it's almost like, it's better not to know, right? There's this prideful ignorance that permeates our diets and our mindsets towards the world, especially in America, where as long as you willfully ignore the source of your food, then everything is okay.
Right.
As long as you willfully ignore the problems in your life, then everything is okay. As long as you willfully ignore the problems in your relationships, then everything is okay, right?
But ignorance is bliss.
But yeah, that's just like a thin layer of falsehood that protects you from the reality, when at the end of the day, the truth is that the reality, by facing it head on, it's going to set you free and it's going to help you grow as a person in all aspects of your life. And food is a huge part of who we are as human beings, right? So why not be more mindful about that, and not just mindful in looking at the labels at the store and saying, oh, that's organic, so that means that that animal must be treated in a good way. It's making small changes in your life. Now, if you live in an urban environment, you might not be able to have chickens, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you can't drive 15 minutes or 30 minutes or even an hour to go support a farmer that has that ability, right? Where you can actually see the chickens where the eggs are coming from, or you can, you know, go to a rancher and split a quarter of cattle with three friends, right? And get meat from a place that you know that animal has been treated properly, and that's going into your body, right?
Yeah.
We're a reflection of the things that we eat. So it makes sense that you want to go to a place where you know that animal's been treated well.
Mm-hmm. I've thought about this a lot, because I think about this very intentionally for like beforehand and after a slaughter, like anytime, it just like sticks with me. And I always find myself and my way of thinking being more akin to a vegan than a mindless meat eater. And people are like, oh, you eat a lot of meat, you must hate vegans. I'm like, no, like some of it I actually kind of understand. Like, they don't want to just like, you know, slay animals. I'm like, I'm kind of like the same way. Like, I want to be close to that animal, and I want to take responsibility for that animal losing its life. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a family where I was like, I would kill a fish. I'd come home, I'd kill a fish, you know, at the creek, whatever. I'd bring it home all stoked. Like, I got dinner. Like, I got a dead fish or a crawdad, or, you know, whatever we did as creek kids. My dad would be like, we don't kill animals. Like, how do you want your steak cooked?
Yeah.
And I was like, what? Yeah. Like, what do you mean? You won't kill animals. You just want to outsource the murder. That's what the reality is like, you're just not willing to have that blood on your hands, and it feels better to outsource that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's important. And I think there's very few people who talk about it. I think there's even fewer people who talk about it at our age. Like, I think most of the people who still have this consciousness are mainly people that are being aged out of like the food processing industry.
Yeah. Or, I mean, if you think about it, grocery stores really haven't been around that long, right? They seem like a normality and something that we take for granted now, but our grandparents and great grandparents, they primarily subsisted on, you know, farming and things that and means of securing dairy from, you know, farmers and other things that, you know, weren't this massive supply chain, right? This massive supply chain delivery. And so we've gotten so far away from that to the point where it's almost disgusting to think about, you know, eggs coming from a chicken or meat coming from an animal. It's separated. It's this thing behind the curtain that it takes place, and then it ends up on the shelves. And I think it's more important than ever to realize that life is raw and real, and it's necessary to immerse oneself in the inner workings of that so that we can pass that on to our kids, right? Pass that knowledge on, that eggs come from chickens and animals are cut up into pieces and put into bags that are then put into grocery stores, right? Yeah. And
animals in the wild die horrible, horrific deaths, oftentimes by having their butthole eaten out by a pack of coyotes. Like, the shot that you double lunged a mule deer with was the best case scenario for that animal to go quickly and like expedite that whole process. Like, it wasn't going to end like that for him. It was going to end nasty and painfully and slow.
Yep.
And a well-placed shot from a hunter. Obviously there's bad people in every group. There's shitty hunters out there that just fire terrible shots and hit animals in the butt. It happens, but a well-placed shot from an intentional hunter is just about the best death that any animal could ask for.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, like you said, I'm sure there's a deer out there right now getting its ass eaten by a mountain lion. So, you know, it's a harsh reality, but I think a lot of people don't understand that hunters contribute to a very valuable cause, which is by limiting carrying capacity. If too many mule deer exist within a certain area, just like if too many humans exist in a certain area, then disease starts to be a problem, right? Or if there are not enough nutrients in the area for the amount of deer that there are, whether that's potable water or you know, forage for them to eat, right? Then animals begin to starve. And so by working together with the Parks and Wildlife Service to understand how many deer are in a given area and then issuing that many tags based off of how many deer there are, hunters are able to create a sustainable environment for these animals so that they can be happy, healthy, and flourishing.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And yeah, the hunter is not the enemy of the animal. It's kind of like this fallacy that, I don't know, a lot of us grew up with. But I'm curious with your story, because I know you weren't necessarily like born into a tree stand. How did you get here? How did you get hyper focused on a life in the outdoors?
Yeah, that's a great question. So growing up, I was a very rebellious kid. And
no.
Yeah. Believe it or not, I got into a lot of trouble growing up. And I think a lot of it stemmed from the fact that, so I was born in England in 1991, and we moved to Atlanta, Georgia until I was 6 years old. And then we moved back until it was around 10, right? 10, something like that, 10, 11. We moved back just after the millennium to Atlanta, Georgia. And I think that moving back and forth a lot and being uprooted from social groups and schools and, you know, my sports teams, it created this mindset for me that, well, if I'm not going to be here long, then I might as well just do whatever I want to do, right? And coming back after the millennium, I started hanging out with older kids, got into drugs, and ended up ultimately getting sent to a wilderness program. But I think it started, I think my interest in the outdoors started before then, because I was really into all sorts of outdoor gadgets, knives, BB guns. My uncle, who was a Native American, he was kind of a mentor and father figure to me, and he gave me a bow and arrow, a trad bow, when I was 10 years old, and I ended up getting it confiscated because I tried to shoot a seagull on the national seashore down in Texas. But
they don't let that fly down there?
No, it's actually, I think it's a felony to kill a seagull. Jesus. So yeah, it was, I'll neither confirm nor deny whether, you know, any animal was pursued on that day, but regardless, I got the bow taken away from me. But I was really into like building Waddle and Daub huts in the backyard, and subscribed to a magazine that I think has since become defunct. It's called North American Hunting Magazine, where they would actually send you samples in the mail of like knives and other hunting sort of stuff. And so I was really into that. And my dad would also, you know, very occasionally take me out on like duck hunts, you know. My uncle was really into duck hunting, and I remember this one time my dad, my uncle, and I went to a duck hunt in Texas, and we were sitting in the blind. It was a muddy blind, and I ended up getting some mud stuck in the barrel.
Solid.
And my dad didn't know anything about hunting, and so I asked my dad, "Hey, what do I do?" And he'll never admit this, but he said, "Just go ahead and blow it out on, you know, when the next ducks fly over." And so I did, and lo and behold, the barrel blew back like out of a cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
And so that hunt was over. Didn't really go on any more hunts after that.
You're lucky that didn't end up worse.
Right, like, right, absolutely. I mean, the barrel could have exploded in my face.
Shrapnel.
I could have gotten hit with shrapnel, yeah. Whatever. We like to say that I killed my first duck that day. I'm not sure whether that actually happened as a result of the shot, but regardless, I got a blue teal mounted.
And by duck, you mean your dad's eardrum.
Yeah, right. So anyways, I was a rebellious kid. I had this interest in hunting and fishing too, but mainly, you know, hunting in the outdoors. And so that combined with my rebellion, my parents saw a solution for my rebellion because I was getting in a lot of trouble. I lived in Atlanta in a predominantly upscale neighborhood, came from a good family, but whenever I had the chance, I'd go over across the tracks to Bankhead to go hang out with Bloods and, you know, buy large amounts of weed and other drugs to sell to kids at my school and stuff like that. So anyways, my mom ended up telling me that I was going. This was the summer before my freshman year of high school. My mom told me that I was going to a summer camp to get extra credit for school. And so she drove me up to the Blue Ridge Mountains to a town called Clayton, Georgia, and took me to this little cabin in town. And these two guys led me into this back room and said, "All right, take off your pants and do monkey squats so we know that you don't have any drugs up your ass." And by that point, I'm like, "Mom, I mean, gone." And so these guys searched me, drove me to the hospital, took blood tests, I assumed a drug test, drove me way up into the woods and stopped on the shoulder of this dirt road and said, "There's a pack in the back with some boots. Put the boots on and walk down this trail." And when I walked down this trail, there was a group of 9 other boys, and they didn't say anything to me. There were 2 staff members, and I ended up spending 2 months in the Blue Ridge Mountains hiking 10 to 15 miles a day, learning how to bow drill fires, learning how to forage and be self-sustainable, and really just learning about the environment. And it was probably the worst experience of my life for the first week, right? Because I'd been deprived of everything that I found identity in, my Xbox Live and my drugs and my music and, you know, all of these things that we identify with. And I tried to run away multiple times. They ended up burrito wrapping me under their tents with a tarp so that I couldn't run away in the middle of the night. And after that first week, I embraced it, you know, and it became something that I really enjoyed. And I think that that was the ultimate foundation of who I am today in terms of my desire to consistently get out in the woods and that peace that it brings me.
What was the turning point when you said, "Okay, I just want to run away. I hate these people," to "Maybe I'm going to hang out here for a minute"? Like, did you learn a cool plant, or was it like getting your first ember? Can you remember a moment where you're like, "Actually, I think I kind of like it here"?
Well, other than getting tackled 3 times by big staff members and realizing, okay, this is probably not going to work. I think that, so the way that this program was called Second Nature Wilderness Program, and it was focused on this system, right, where you move from earth phase to fire phase to water phase to air phase, and you have to fulfill certain criteria in order to move on to the next phase. And the first phase, you're not able to talk to anybody. They give you a plastic spoon, and within the first 24 hours under supervision, you have to actually carve a spoon out of wood to be able to eat food, right? And I think the alienation was a big part of why I felt the desire to run away from my circumstance. But once I was able to connect with the other boys and hear about their story and take part in the activities like learning how to source my own bow drill, learning how to identify the flora and fauna in the area, it became something that I was a part of, kind of like Lord of the Flies, right? Where you're part of this society and everybody has a part to play, and it's bigger than you at that point. Mm-hmm. And I think that prior to that moment of being welcomed into the group, right, where they actually build a big sort of shrine where you walk into it. It's made completely out of things from the woods, and everybody's around you. They've all been in your position, right? But they're welcoming you in and sort of ushering you into a new way of life. I think that's when there was that turning point where I realized, hey, I might be able to get some benefit out of this. I might be able to make some changes, right? Because I think most kids that are rebellious or doing the self-sabotaging act, it's not like they pride themselves in doing that as much as it is they feel like they don't have a means of escaping that. They don't have any tools to be able to escape that, or any hope to look to. I'd like to say that that was the turning point in my life. I actually, 6 weeks into the 8-week program, they had a traveling therapist that would come out and talk to us and pretty much get us to write accountability letters to our parents and say like, oh yeah, this is all of the shit that I've done wrong in my life. So, we put together all of these accountability letters, and in response, I got a packet telling me that I was going to boarding school in Utah for a year. So 8 weeks comes. You never knew when you were going to leave, right? 8 weeks comes. We're reading Lord of the Flies. And when they're gathering for the blowing of the conch shell, the staff leader mentioned my name and said, and now it's your time to leave. 15 minutes. And I was packed up and headed to the airport in a car, right? After spending 8 weeks with these boys, 8 weeks with these boys and going through shit, man. It was raining the whole time. We were all singing the songs of the time together just to make it through, Sublime and all of that stuff. And it was like in an instant, I was gone back to civilization, which was a shock. Took a shower, got driven straight to the airport, ate a steak, cried in front of my parents, threw up the steak, and flew to Utah for like 12 months. And then came back from Utah, was doing well for a while, but again, fell into that sort of sense of hopelessness and ended up getting in a lot of trouble for accidentally burning down a house in the woods behind the property behind my school. It was nothing malicious or anything, but a friend and I were we found this house. It was homecoming that weekend, that night actually. And
or was it home burning?
Yeah, so we ended up cleaning up the house because we wanted to have an after party there, burning a bunch of stuff in the fireplace, and apparently asbestos in the chimney caught on fire, burned the whole thing to the ground. And my friend ended up talking about it, and arson detectives at school on Monday, and there was that, and then there was other stuff with drugs, and ended up getting kicked out of school, going to school in Denmark for a while. And after school in Denmark didn't work out because I was still down the path of just partying, doing whatever I wanted to do, no meaning, no purpose, just an endless spiral down. My mom, once again, love you, mom, but told me that I was going to go to public school, wake up 3 days after arriving back in Atlanta to three guys in military uniforms around my bed in the middle of the night, threw me an orange jumpsuit, told me I was going to Bonifay, Florida. And I ended up spending 12 months in a high security lockdown evangelistic military school. Yeah. So
that's crazy.
Yeah. Crazy story, right? You know, I still didn't get it. Yeah. After that, I still didn't get it. I still didn't feel like I had purpose. I was definitely more on the straight and narrow. Graduated from military school, went to a Christian internship in Tyler, did well there for a little while, found a way to get out and go to community college down in Austin, lived with my aunt and uncle, still wasn't figuring it out, ended up getting into University of Texas, still wasn't figuring it out, and then I went and traveled, right? I was traveling with a buddy for 3.5 weeks through Southeast Asia. We flew into Singapore, we went up to Malaysia, and then up to Thailand, and went from, you know, did the whole Bangkok, Chiang Mai, and then ended in Ayutthaya, which is the old capital of Thailand. And we were planning on going back from Singapore, and, you know, I kept thinking to myself, man, I don't have any obligations. I don't know what I want to do with my life. I'm not going back. Right. And I told my buddy that, and he's like, dude, you're nuts. Right. And I'm like, yeah, I know I'm nuts. I've got like $1,000 in my bank account, you know, just enough to get back home. Ended up telling my parents, they're like, no, don't do this. Don't do this. And I ended up getting a job teaching English in this small town of Ayutthaya, about 30 minutes outside of Bangkok. And ended up living there for 2.5 years, working my way up into the international school circuit, started a swim lessons company with my girlfriend at the time, met a lot of great people, traveled all over Southeast Asia, went to Australia for a year with the money that I'd made, did the work holiday visa, picked fruit on farms, bartended on the Great Barrier Reef, spearfished every day, met a great group of guys called the Slush Puppies that took me in as the dumb American. And then ended up going to Nepal and India to solo to one. Well, I went to Nepal to hike the Annapurna circuit with a buddy from the Slush Puppies, and then went to India because I had a tax return come through that I didn't even know about, that I got like, you know, $5,000 or something, and ended up going to India and doing a Vipassana 10-day silent meditation. And you know, it was this great long journey, but I was up in Ladakh, which is the far northernmost part of India. And, you know, I'm every day just riding around my motorcycle, looking for the next place to score hash, and realized like, man, you know, I don't have any money in the bank. I don't have any security. I don't have any health insurance. Like, what am I doing? And I made the decision to go home and save up some money so that I could go back and do more traveling. And I met this girl who ended up becoming my wife, and we now have a daughter, and got a job in technology, and that brought us to Colorado. And, you know, I'd always had this, like, this all goes to say, like, I did a lot, right? A lot of outdoor stuff, but when we got to Colorado, I was introduced to a guy who was really into hunting. He hunted his whole life. He was born in a tree stand, as you mentioned, and he was like, hey, you want to come out for a turkey hunt? And, you know, the thought of that definitely intrigued me. I was into guns. I had never shot a bow other than that traditional bow that I'd gotten prior, but he was instrumental. His name is Tyler Wilkinson, and he goes by Tit. And he ended up moving back to Georgia, but he really introduced me to the ropes of hunting. And I remember that first time we went out for that turkey hunt. We were ultimately unsuccessful, but we were sitting in the blind, and it was really early in the morning, and all of a sudden this turkey just goes off its fucking head like 30 yards from us. And it was one of the most bone chilling and adrenaline inducing things that I'd ever experienced. And I think from that moment on, I was just hooked on the idea of getting out into the woods in a way that wasn't passive, right? Mm. You can hike through the woods all you want, but when you're tuned up to 10 with your eyes and your ears and your nose, and you are actively pursuing game, I think that that is the most primal thing that you can do. And it's a real connection to our heritage.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a special moment for sure. And it's a feeling I wish more people got to experience, because it was something I always thought about growing up. Like, I grew up in a family that was like, absolutely no hunting. Like, wasn't even the question. So I was always just like making spears and spear fishing and like getting as close as I could, throwing rocks at squirrels, because I just like had this like innate interest. Like, no one harbored it in me. Nobody even told me about it. I just like wanted to go in the woods and like figure out how to stay there for a long time, like from as early as I can remember. And I feel like, you know, sometimes that's the case. Sometimes the case is you just need to be introduced and have that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so rare for folks to get that feeling now. That's why the importance of having a mentor or somebody to take you out on one of those first trips is such an essential key piece of that formula.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of times people don't know where to start with hunting, right, or fishing, especially if they don't have any exposure to it from a family member, or they live in an area where they perceive that they can't get into something like that.
Yeah.
Right. So having a mentor is a great thing. But now we've got this thing called social media and the internet where you can connect with like-minded individuals. You can follow people like Steve Ranella or, you know, a variety of other resources that really put hunting into this easy to digest format, right? That wasn't present not so long ago. It used to be, you know, if you were into hunting and you wanted to learn about the educational resources, then you'd have to go to like Eastman, you know, Bow Hunting Journal, or a lot of these like really, really stereotypical hunting videos. Not to throw any shade on them, but, you know, if you grew up in a city environment, even struggling to understand those guys and, you know, their country accents and, you know, just the way that they were raised is difficult, right? Mm-hmm. Because you struggle to relate to them. But now the world's become such a much smaller place where you can seek out people that are like you, right? Yeah. Or that you relate to and that are hunting, to be able to learn from them and sort of take that first leap into the great outdoors.
Yeah, I think it's interesting with me and you, like, kind of met through our community that's kind of like fitness oriented, because that's a huge part of both of our lives. But then we also like have this other part of our life. Like, I feel like both of us have the same two-prong lifestyle,
yeah,
which is like health and wellness and then the outdoors.
Yeah.
And it just like happens that we could have met through like the outdoors one and then realized we also were both into health and wellness. But we like met there in a sauna, and then I was like, oh, you hunt? And you're like, yeah, you hunt? I was like, yeah. And then like takes off from there.
Yeah.
And it's a connection, like our connection would have probably never happened 20 years ago. It all happened actually through social media and through this giant machine. So
yeah,
there is,
yeah,
some good that comes out of it.
Yeah. Big shouts out to Eric Henman. That guy,
he gets too many shouts out on the pod.
He's a connector.
He's a freaking connector.
Yeah, he's a connector of people.
He is a freaking connector. You know,
if it weren't for that sauna session, I would have made a great friend, multiple great friends.
Dude, the sauna is where you get the connection.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is because the phones overheat.
Yeah.
So you're like sitting like 3 feet away from another human and neither of you have a phone in your hands.
Yeah. You're forced to interact.
We're about to have a long conversation.
Yeah. I also think that the heat lowers inhibitions and a means of being able to discuss topics that you wouldn't normally discuss, right? Because you're simulating exhaustion in a vacuum chamber, right?
Yeah.
And so you have a lot of in-depth conversations about things that you wouldn't normally discuss with, in the case of Muscle Mountain, many times absolute strangers, right? But always people that are incredibly creative, incredibly inspired, and that's a recipe for greatness, right?
Yeah, it's also a little bit of like trauma bonding. Like if me and you meet in the kitchen, we're both like comfortable, like maybe like not really going through it. If we're both in the sauna and it's 200 plus degrees, we're like, fuck man, we're going through this together. Like yeah. we're both like in this, like this kind of yeah. sucks. Doesn't this suck? Yeah, man, this sucks. Yeah. Like, you know, you yeah. kind of open up a little bit quicker that way.
Yeah, totally.
What's the, cause kind of when we left off on that story, you hinted at the fact that came here and had Suri, your daughter.
Yeah.
What's been the biggest thing with the hunting and fishing outdoors lifestyle? How has that changed with having a kid?
Yeah, I mean, when I first started hunting, I'm not going to lie, I was using it as a means of escape to get out and, you know, go party with my friends. I think a lot of men do that, right? Where they use the masquerade of hunting as a reason to drink with your buddies. Mm. And so when I first started hunting, I was definitely doing that a lot. As things have progressed, as I've become a father and a husband and have started to take my life more seriously in terms of my fitness and mental well-being, I've definitely separated myself from alcohol. And that has enabled me to focus more on the hunting and the immersion in the outdoors, right? Which yeah. is what I think I was looking for all along. And as a result of that, I think that my success in terms of harvest has just skyrocketed.
Absolutely.
I mean, last year I was able to harvest 2 turkeys in one season. Prior to that, I'd been out for 3 years unsuccessful, right?
Just getting trashed with the boys.
Yeah. I mean, they're, you know, if you're going to drink until 1 a.m. and then expect to get up at 5 a.m. and go out and kill a bird, it's not going to work. No. And if it does, you know, good for you, but generally speaking, your chances of harvesting an animal are going to be higher if you're mentally keen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, it's interesting to hear all this because, I mean, we're both doing 75 hard right now, yeah. which was kind of your idea. And I just kind of hopped on. And yeah. since I've known you, you don't drink.
Yep.
You're not like a partier. And then I hear all these stories and it's kind of like a double life. Somebody that I never knew. It's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, now I just see the guy that gets up at 4 a.m. every day and takes a cold shower. And then he does yoga. And then he does, I don't remember the order, but you put him online every day.
Yeah. I'm putting together a video of that with a behind the scenes actually right now, because I do want to share that, you know, it's really easy to portray an ideal perspective on Instagram, but there's a lot that goes into it, right? Yeah. So my daily routine is that I wake up at 4 a.m. and I'm usually in the shower by 4:05. After that, I get ready, pack up my bag, go pray, meditate, read, write in my journal, get on the computer to check some emails, formulate my day, get a head start, and then go downstairs, you know, take my supplements and go to the gym, do my gym routine, do my sauna routine, come back, take care of my daughter, make sure she's ready to go to school, and then start my day, right? But there's a lot that goes into that. I think that David Goggins, he said one time that sometimes he'll just stare at his shoes for right. like 30 minutes and be like, nah, fuck you, man. I'm not going to, nah, man. Nah. But he's staring at those shoes, right? Like sometimes I'll look at that shower and I'll just let the water run for a little bit and stare at it and be like, man, I don't want to do this. I really don't want to do this. And I think a lot of people have this misconception that I thoroughly enjoy doing this thing day in, day out, and recording it and sharing that with other people for validation. But the reality of it is that many times I don't enjoy doing these things, and I'm not doing it for validation. I'm doing it as a mantra to myself, because I think that somebody once said, like, imagine your life like it's a movie, right? When you're reviewing the footage, if you look back on it, are you going to be impressed? Are you going to be disgusted? Are you going to be bored? Mm. God forbid, right? And for me, Instagram is a great tool to be able to have a running tally of the things that I'm doing so that I can look back on them and be proud, and then archive them, and then potentially show my daughter, show my future kids, look back on it in, you know, 20 years and see where I've gotten to as a result of the really little shit that I did over a long period of time.
Yeah, I think that's That's sort of so I got this from another guest. His name's Jason Hardrath. I don't know if you've heard of him. He mm-hmm. did the Rocky Mountain Grand Slam. And that what you're saying is a condensed version, but he had an incredible way of thinking about it. And it's like, sit down for a minute and just imagine yourself talking to God. You're dead. You're just a spirit at this point. You're in heaven. You talk to God and you say, how close did I get? How close did I get to 100% of my potential?
Yeah.
And what you're saying is basically looking at your life and reviewing it in that similar light, but maybe in a year or 10 years or 20 years.
Yeah. I mean, it's like there are so many things that we can't control in this life that it's nice to be able to have a little bit of control. And one of the things that you can generally control is your non-negotiables and the routine that you set for yourself, right? Because the person that you become is just a result of these small habits that you formulate over a long period of time, and things come up for sure, right? But for me, I think there are a couple things that are non-negotiables, you know, whether it's that I'm going to do yoga, or whether it's, you know, I'm going to get physical exercise today, or I'm going to journal or read or learn something new, right? Like these are things that I just have as non-negotiables in my life, and I'm not going to make an excuse and say, oh, I can't do it because I'm sick, or because mm-hmm. my daughter's sick, or because I had a bad day at work or whatever. It's like, these are things that I think stack up over time. If you just continue to do them over and over and over again, you become better at them, but you also remind yourself that regardless of all the shit that's going on, there are things that you can control in your life.
Yeah. And that was kind of what we were talking about earlier, which is I've fallen off a bit on my everyday breath work. I used to be absolutely religious about it. And Lauren, like, it took her some time getting used to it, because I locked the doors and I go and do my breath work. And when we were first dating, she was kind of like, what is he doing when he like locks himself in a little room like that?
Yeah.
And it was every single day. I never missed. And then, you know, for me, it'll be like I'm training for a 100-miler and I'm getting exhausted, putting in big volume. And I'm just like, I don't have to do breath work today. And then I got back on it today and I was like, that is why.
Yeah.
Like this feeling right here, this mental clarity, this incredible feeling of consciousness and proficiency. Like when I get through my routine, I feel like, okay, I'm able to do exactly what I want to do. I have everything I need and nothing that I don't. And that kind of moment was like, damn, I need to get back on the train and truly make it a non-negotiable. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. And think about this. You'll be running that 100-mile race and you'll be going through a really shitty point and you'll realize your breath work routine and you'll implement that. And in that moment, you'll realize, oh shit, that's why I was doing this.
Mm.
Because during periods of hardship or periods where you really need to implement it, you've tested yourself in circumstances or situations where you might not necessarily have needed it, but you were practicing for those times when you need it. Right. Mm. And that's the way that I see my routine is like, I doubt that a guy's going to hold a gun to my head and say, oh, take a 10-minute cold shower right now. And I'll be like, oh, yeah, I've been practicing for this. No, but I can use that application to face a stressful situation where it's like, what if I'm out ice fishing one day and, you know, God forbid, the ice cracks, right? Mm-hmm. And instead of losing my shit in that moment, I'm able to calm myself down, utilize the application of breath work and mindfulness and improved stress response as a result of cold plunging in order to collect my thoughts and figure out how the fuck I'm going to get out of that hole.
Yeah.
You know,
there's an interesting study. I don't have the reference number, but I can find it. It's, they did two. So first one was a group of athletes and they didn't tell them how long it was going to be, but they put all of their hands in water and said, keep it in there as long as it can be. Turned out it was a 3-minute time cap, but nobody knew that. The average person who was not an athlete used to succumbing to like really hard physical challenges, it was like a minute and 32 seconds they were able to hold their hand in. And most every athlete time capped and got to 3 minutes and they're like, you're done. Because those folks had just been used to pushing their body, that they weren't panicked. And then they did it even again. They like formulated it down to runners, specifically to runners. And runners like outperformed even regular athletes, because like your ability during running to hold like a sub tempo pace and just feel like your lungs are literally about to explode. Or on 100 mile, you've been running for 22 hours and me and you have a long, fast descent into a canyon. We've got to rip down it. Runners just like have this ability to like withstand pain that a sedentary person wouldn't have. And yeah, I think it's cool when science can kind of articulate those things that maybe we intuitively believe to be true.
Yeah. I mean, how many people do you talk to that don't run long distance that can't fathom the idea of running 100 miles?
I don't even want to drive my car 100 miles.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I couldn't even walk, you know, 10 miles. It's like, okay, for sure. But then you talk to anybody that's run 50 miles and that conversation is a little bit more different, right? Yeah. Where they're like, I don't know if I could necessarily run 100 miles, but I could definitely try,
yeah.
Right? Because they've crossed that threshold, that mental threshold, where I think after you complete your first marathon, if you're still in it and you had a good experience, then you kind of want to try, a lot of people want to try a little bit more, right? Yeah. Especially more now, right? But I think runners, athletes, people that have been through hardships, people in the military, you talk to them and they're just able to channel this other place in their brain, right? Mm-hmm. The dark place, right? Where they go, where, you know, they realize that when they go to that place, they're able to go on autopilot and go somewhere else, to a place that's happy or to a place that's not fucking horrible, right? For that moment,
mm-hmm.
Right? My drill instructor, he used to say, you can do anything for 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then the 2 minutes would be up and he'd be like, you can do anything for 2 minutes. And it's like, it's kind of true, right? You yeah. set these small blocks in your mind where as long as you can complete that, then it's a new day, right? Yeah. As long as we could get through the night on that run yeah. and watch that sun come up, we were new, you know, we would be new people. And we were. It was yeah. like, I think a lot of people, they only see what's in front of them, right? They only see, oh, well, I don't know when I'm going to be able to take my hands out of that cold water. So it could be 5 minutes, it could be 10 minutes, it could be 30 minutes, right? And that's the thing that starts to play tricks on you. But I think that athletes, they realize, oh, all I got to do is run 5 yards to the next first down. And then after that, all I got to do is run another 10 yards to the next first down and another 10 and another 10. And they break it up into small, manageable pieces.
Yeah.
And that enables them to continue going. It doesn't matter how long they need to go. All that matters is that little extra bit in front of them to push further than they are right now.
Yeah, it just proves how mental all of like the physical things and how combined the body and the mind are. Like a great example that just came to mind while you were saying that is, think about rock climbing or even bouldering more mm-hmm. specifically. You're working on a bouldering problem. It looks really hard and you don't know if you can do it. And you try and you fail 10 times, 20 times. Now it's like you've been working on this for a week and you still can't get it. And then you get it once. You somehow get it once. Just knowing that you got it, now you're able to lap it. You can literally do it on command, probably with 90% proficiency, mm-hmm. because now you know you can do it. And it's just about having that belief, like, I know I can do this and therefore I will.
Yeah.
It's an interesting concept, and you see it a lot at the climbing gym. Yeah. I know I've been there before.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that can be applied to other aspects of your life too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Things can seem daunting at work. Things can seem daunting in relationships. But all it takes is one small step in the right direction to figuring out that it doesn't seem daunting as long as you break it up into these manageable, addressable pieces, right? Because when you look at the full rock wall, it does seem daunting and it seems like you'll never be able to complete it. But as long as you look at this one small section of how you can get up to this point right here, then everything back there is behind you. You've managed that. You're able to put it into your toolbox and you can do that again, right? Yeah,
just breaking it up into manageable pieces.
Yeah.
Just like hunting. Like hunting, especially mountain hunting, is like if you just told someone what it consists of, it was like, oh yeah, 25,000 steps a day, 12 miles, maybe some of those miles with 60 pounds on your back, camping, probably in the rain, you down? And someone would be like, that sounds horrible. Impossible. Yeah. Why would I ever want to even try that? And then you're like, well, okay, let's break it down. You break that down in manageable pieces and you see the success that comes from it. That's what keeps you coming back to the woods.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, I think if folks want to give you a follow, maybe it's a good idea to tell them where to find your outdoor content and best way to connect with you.
Yeah. So I'm on TikTok at Kill and Cook, KillnCook.
That's a good name.
And I post a lot of content that is focused around teaching people about the outdoors. I write a lot of poetry, always have. And I began to combine that with a lot of footage from the years of me being out in the woods, trying to convey the message of immersing yourself in the outdoors and having a true appreciation for nature and sustainability. I'm also on Instagram at Austin Nicholas. It's with one N. So AustinNicholas. Mm. And yeah, I post all of my TikTok content there as well, as a lot of more graphic content that TikTok does not allow. Graphic as in, you know, stuff related to blood and guts and,
yeah,
you know, things that people want to see. But yeah, I, you know, I'm just really grateful to be on this podcast and really grateful to share the wonders of nature. I think that more than ever, we need to teach our generation and teach the next generations the importance of keeping the dream of the woods alive, because we're so caught up in technology, and technology is a good thing, but I think what's more important is realizing our roots as human beings came from the wild and came from the solitude of being out in the woods with no distractions and communion with the animals of the land and with nature.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I love what you're doing, and I'm excited to see all the content that is to come.
Thanks, man.
All right, y'all. Stay wild.